Blog Talk Radio.
There's a direct relationship between having the businesses and being in prison. Go find an Asian, see how many Asians you can find in American prisons. They ain't going to be in there. But 51% of your prison will be black because blacks don't have any businesses and industries. There's a direct link. Blacks won't practice group economics. Blacks won't practice group politics. If you don't practice, you're setting yourself up. And I told that five-story building, you're setting yourself to get wiped out. Understand the nature of race, which is economics. If you build the first floor, it's economic. Build your businesses and your industries. Control buildings and industry, and put that pulls in your money, and hold that money, and practice group economics with it. Arab and Asian money bounces 12 to 13 times for a lead. Jewish money bounces 18 times. Black folks got to learn how to practice group economics. Black Americans spend every penny they get outside their own community. Then you take the money and the wealth that you get from that first floor and go to the second floor. The second floor is politics. You then take that money on the first floor and you control your politics. Black folk must quit allowing people to tell them to go out and vote. Vote for what? Nobody's going to do anything for black folk in politics. Politics is controlled by money. Major corporations, who got the money? That's what controls politics. If you have no money, you have no say-so, you have no benefits coming. So you take your money and you control, and you take your money on the first floor, you buy every politician on the second floor. And any politician you can't buy, you rent or lease them to get what you need. Then once you get the second floor under control with your politician, with your money, then you go to the third floor. The third floor then is the police department and the court system. You take your money from the first floor and your politics on the second floor, and you control the court system and the police department. Then the fourth floor, then is media. You then take the money that you generate off the first floor from business and industries, and you go after radio stations, TV stations, newspapers, and cable systems so that you can now inform and communicate with your own people. Right now, black folk only control less than 35 thousandths of 1% of the media in the United States. Out of 12,000 radio stations, black folk own about 75 or 80. That's all. You own no cable systems. You don't have a daily newspaper. You have nothing of importance. You got about one black TV station. So you can't communicate with your people. You can't inform your people. You can't do anything. You can have Rush Limbaugh and all the rest of the guys talking about racism all day long and bad-mouthing you. And O'Reilly, they can call black folk all kind of names all day long. What are you going to do? You can't respond. You can't even communicate with your own people because you don't have an economic base. 51% of all the prisons in the United States are black people. You only make up 12% of the population. That's no accident. It's because you don't control the economics and the politics. And they're going to go after the weakest people they can get their hands on to incarcerate. That's the black folk. And what are you going to do in response to them when they over-incarcerate you? You're going to go out and have a march, a demonstration. We're going to march. March, who cares? Marching, they never changed anything.
Bye.
Many a young athlete entertains hoop dreams. Few, if any, have tried as hard to make them come true as the kid our Steve Hartman has gone to see.
Every week, he set himself up for disappointment. Every week, 13-year-old Jamarian Stiles came to this community center in Boca Raton, Florida, hoping to play basketball with the other kids. And every week, he was rejected.
They'll start picking teams, and I would be the only one left out. And then they'll just tell me, just go home and stuff. You can break someone's heart like that.
The problem was obvious to everyone but Jamarian. He lost his hands and most of his arms as an infant due to a rare bacterial infection. But he insisted that was no reason to give up his hoop dreams.
What about soccer? Have you heard of that sport?
Yeah, hear it every day.
Why don't you play soccer? That just seems like the obvious thing.
You would think that I would be good at soccer. I'm really not. I'm horrible.
Which is why, on the first day of class here at Eagles Landing Middle School, Jamarian took his case to basketball coach Darian Williams.
Yeah.
Said he wanted to be on the team this year.
I said, all great, well, just make sure you try out.
He said, okay, great, but what are you really thinking?
This man has no arms.
Yeah.
How is he going to play basketball? But, man, he told me, Mr. Williams, I've never been on a team before. Even if I don't play, I just want to be on the team. And how could I say no to that?
And that's how the Eagles got their first armless basketball player. Jamarian, number two there, quickly earned a reputation as the hardest worker on the squad.
He was usually the first one in the gym, usually the last one to leave.
Still, he sat on the bench most of the season.
Try one more.
Until last month. Coach put him in the game with about 6 minutes left. And when he eventually got the ball on the far side of the court, everyone yelled, shoot it! So he did. And sank. A three-pointer. And if you didn't quite see that, don't worry. Because shortly after, he got the ball again. This time on the near side. For another three-pointer. At the buzzer. Jamarian Stiles, the kid no one would pick, was now everyone's hero. Needless to say, today, Jamarian can play all he wants at the community center. He just made the volleyball team and has every intention of playing football next year. Really, the only thing he won't play is the victim.
If I could wave a magic wand right now and give you your arms back, would you want them?
I don't need them.
You don't need them?
No.
Who needs hands when you've got this kind of touch?
Now learn this from Joel Osteen. That's my man. He be texting me. That's my man. This God done put some people around me, show me some stuff. He was telling this story. He said, this man that went to heaven, he was walking with Peter down this aisleway, and it was going down this corridor, had a lot of doors on it, and said all these doors had names on it. And he said, Peter, let me ask you something. What's all these doors, these names on? He said, don't worry about it. Just go ahead. So he kept walking. And he messed around. He saw one of them doors and had his name on it. He said, whoa. He said, hey, Peter, this here ain't got my name on it. Something I need to know? He said, man, don't worry about that. You here now. Just go on in there and talk to him. See what he said, nah, I won't know what's in the door. He said, you sure you won't see what's in the door? He said, yeah. So he opened up the door. It was a warehouse. It had nothing but shelves on it. And then the shelves had nothing but packages. And all the packages had his name on them. And he said, what is all these boxes? He said, that's all of the blessings, all of the things God wanted to ship to you. But number one, you didn't ask him for it. Then number two, you didn't believe you would have it. Then you doubted him. And then you felt like you wasn't worthy. And so now all these boxes is up here. Now the man standing there wishing he had never even been in the room. And I started thinking. I got some dudes that work for me. And I said, I want you to do this graph for me. And that's what I'm finna show you now. See, what you happen is, when God sends your package, he only sends it to one street. That's Faith Street. You got to stay in faith. You can't move off of Faith Street. You can't get on Doubted Drive. You can't be over there and start doubting it because your package going to go right on by. You can't lose your faith and get on Not Meant to Be way, because your package is going to keep going right on by. Because the package just go to Faith Street. You can get your little feelings hurt, I ain't worthy. Guess what? Your package going to keep going right on by. You have not because you ask not. Then you sit up here and start feeling sorry for yourself. You go on pity way, your package keep going right on by. If you stay right on Faith Street, don't ever come off, because the blessing is coming. If you wait on it, here it comes. It may not come when you want it, but it on time. But if you get up and you move off of Faith Street, your box gonna get sent back to sender. And now you're gonna have a warehouse with a bunch of boxes with your name on it that you didn't never get. And I don't know about you, but I want everything he got for me. If he got something for me, I need all of mine. Because I don't know about you, but God lay you out, man. God will give you stuff. Man, he done took me places I ain't never thought I was going to go. I done seen parts of the world I never even thought I could go to. He done gave me stuff. He done put people in my life. God will do it for you, man. But you just got to stay, man. Use these principles of success. Understand, God is just that way. He'll lay you out. Because if he can lay me out, see, if he fix me and change me and get me over here trying to do better, I ain't perfect. I'm just trying to do better. I still say some stuff I ain't supposed to say. You understand? I ain't got it all together yet. I just got in the gate. I'm a new kind of Christian. But ain't no lock on my gate either. So if you see, once you check me, I'm probably going to check you back. But I'm getting better at that. I don't know how to love my enemies yet. I'm getting better at it, though. But it's a process. And the more times we can make people understand that it's a process, the more people can come in. And y'all people that have been good to me, that have been praying for me. I mean, man, my mama, if she could see me now, I just wish my mama could see me. Because she been praying for this hill all her life. Watch my son. Well, he done watched me, mama. And I'm cool now. And my philosophy is very simple. I was who I was, but I am who I am. And I'm cool with both them people. Because who I was wasn't that bad a chap. I made some mistakes, but I've been changed a little bit. And it's still a process. And the more people that you invite into the process, the better this is. Because ain't nobody perfect no how. So I really appreciate y'all, man, hearing me and listening to me.
I was talking to a cat the other night. See, what everybody's looking for is, what everybody's looking for today, they're looking for escapism. You know what? I love to get down, Jack.
Yeah.
And when I get down, you understand, I don't have to go into no funny bag. Say, I can't do this. I mean, say what I want, man. I can't, you understand? That's the way I feel. You know, I believe I get down right about here.
Right on.
But if I get down, you know, Bud got out of sight, too, coming up. We got a record button right here, you know.
Sure.
So we're trying to get our thing out of the way before Bud gets into it. Bud, come here, get on before we...
Yeah.
Is it all right?
Yeah.
Bud, do you think it's going to be a hit, Bud, you cut?
Oh, yeah.
You think it's going to be a hit? But I know it's a smash. I know it's a smash. Because you're in the thing, man. You're the same way it's at, you know. It's got to be a hit.
Man. I don't like the hood. What you say, Fred?
I said we better take it on the lamb out here.
We better watch the man.
But
come over here, brother. Let me tell you. You think we're talking too loud?
Hush that butt.
I ain't got no dust.
I don't have to take it on the land.
Watch that man.
Huh?
Watch that man.
Watch them. Yeah, all right. You're right. Yeah. Coming from some funny places. What'd you say, bro?
What's happening? Down.
Trying to get down.
Yeah.
Well, you know, look at him. We can't have that.
That's right. Right on. Yeah.
Ain't no alcohol. Man, I don't dig it. What you say, J-Ton?
Hey, don't be so mean.
You know I'm clean now. Yeah.
And on the sea.
Excuse me, Cap, while I rap. Say some shit to y'all that I seen yesterday that made me smile, but it hurt me to my heart. There's a house next door to me that's been abandoned, and the yard, the grass, high as hell and everything. There's a couple of abandoned cars out there beside the house. Well, yesterday I get off work about 7 o'clock. A Mexican guy pulled up. He said, "These your cars?" I said, "No." He said, "I just bought this house, man." I said, "All right, that's what's up." He was like, "You know whose cars it is?" He said, "No." He said, "Well, I bought the house, not the cars." Okay, I'm like, cool. I'm thinking he's just coming to look at the house. I go back in the house, do a little straighten up. I swear to God, I walk back at the house. Now, I'm getting off about 7:20. It's fucking 9 Mexican trucks just pull up. They got fucking beer, lights, and shit, right? So I'm like, what y'all finna do? He said, "We finna fix this house." I said, "What kind of crew you got working after 7 o'clock? He said, "These my friends." The fucking house is fixed this morning. They went in there and drywalled that fucking house. I just left out of there. It was a fucking abandoned house. That bitch looked new this morning. Whew. It was an abandoned fucking house. And it looked new this morning. It's an old African proverb. Many hands make light work. I just don't think they're better than us. I just think we won't do nothing together. Wow. You're not hearing what the fuck I'm saying. It was an abandoned house yesterday at 7:15. That bitch is new this morning. He bought a tax lien house. I can't wait to see what they do. I can't wait to see, is one family going to live in there? Is they going to... I'm going to get to know the motherfuckers. You best believe me, when I make some money, I'm going to do it. I'm going to bring us together. And I'm not fucking with a lot of people.
People keep talking about how the world is going to come to an end. And I wonder, in these days and these times, if anybody likes to say, is anybody people keep talking about how society is falling down today. And as hard as I try not to listen just to what them folks got to say. But you know, I just can't help but look around and see we digging our own grave.
And there's just one thing I want to know. Can anybody be saved?
Some people got to have. woman will sell her precious body. For a small piece of paper, it carries a lot of weight. For that
we're here in what we have called, everybody calls it Black History Month, February, but we are calling, well, we got three titles for this month. Slave Entrepreneur Month, where we feature many slaves, not all, but many, that started life legally as slaves and became entrepreneurs. Some of them have become wealthy entrepreneurs. And I think we're on day 8 now. And Black Towns History Month, which we're going to talk about. Most of the black towns we talked about in recent years have been all here in the United States for the most part. I think we did one in Columbia, the country, but today we're going to bring out a different type of black township based on geography. Anyway, today's podcast is titled Mississippi and Alabama, excuse me, Mississippi and Africa, Artesian Economics versus Reparations USA. Now, one of the reasons why I'm doing a month-long series on slave entrepreneurship is because I truly believe, you can debate me on this, that, you know what, instead of reading a lot of these self-help books out here, and you don't have to be black for this, you can be any race or whatever, or color. Instead of reading Robert Kiyosaki's Rich Dad, Poor Dad, Napoleon Hill's, what do you call it, The Think and Grow Rich, The Law of Success, The Magic of Thinking Big by David Swart, throw all those books out. I believe that if you study the slave entrepreneurs during the slave era here in the United States, or what we now call the United States, I think you'll get more solid, usable information that you can act on like immediately when it comes to personal finance and the development of corporate business or corporate finance. Today, once again, our title for the podcast is Mississippi and Africa, Artesian Economics versus Reparations USA. Now, let's start off with Reparations USA. You now have in 2022 a few cities in the United States that on the local level, the local politicians are in the process of passing or they have passed their version of reparations for that particular community. Asheville, North Carolina is working on a bill of such nature. Evanston, Illinois has passed a reparations bill. I believe Detroit's working on something. But none of these bills, to my knowledge, are based on slavery, where they got the idea from anyway. Now, some people want reparations to come in the form of cutting us a check. All right. Because reparations can come in different forms. But, you know, for the sake of this podcast today, for the reparations crowd, they want a reparations check. So we're going to take a look at the check, the reparations side, the check as a form of reparations. But let's first take a look at Mississippi and Africa and Artesian Economics. Now, we have already laid out some people that were, and you can fact check me on this, this is, everything I've said has been online for the last 8 days when it comes to slave entrepreneurship. Mother Priscilla Baltimore, born a slave in Missouri, bought her freedom. Bought her freedom. Now, some people, because there's a lot of people running around, and some have graduated from HBCUs, historically black colleges and universities, that they go around thinking and believing that slaves weren't paid. Well, maybe some weren't, but a whole lot were. Mother Priscilla Baltimore was one of them. She bought her freedom. She also continued to work. Now, first people are asking, well, what kind of job did she have? That's why we have the title that we have today, Artesian Economics. The majority of slaves that became free and bought their freedom were artisan. What is an artisan? Is someone who makes something. So these people, some made brooms, some made mops, some made furniture, some were carpenters, some were metal workers, some knew how to, you know, do infrastructure and build roads. Okay, some were shipbuilders, like Paul Cuffy during colonial times. So with these artisan skills, and essentially that was the economic engine for a lot of people who owned slaves, because that particular person, let's say you owned a slave, and you can, and then you hired, you bought a slave, which is for them was an investment, that had the skill set of being a carpenter, and because they're different type of carpenters. Let's say the carpenter, the slave that you got, that you purchased, had the skill set of being a furniture carpenter or a landscape carpenter or a shipbuilding carpenter. You as the slave owner, without having none of that skill set, you can, back then, you can purchase someone, in this case, an African or a black person in the United States as we know it today. You can hire that person and make a business out of it with regular hours. Now, many slave owners that had that type of arrangement, where they had a skilled artisan slave on their plantation. After business hours over for me, you know, if you want to go out and build a piece of furniture or a bed or a table or a boat or a ship or whatever, brooms, whatever you want, you can go out and make that money, and that's your money. Some said, well, you can go out and make extra money if you do what you need to do for me during our business hours. And then, you know, what you go out, when you go out and make your extra money, give me a cut. Give me a 5 or 10% commission. That's how they were able to make the money, like a Mother Priscilla Baltimore, like a Frank McWhorter, like thousands of them. Not a few hundred, but thousands of blacks over. Because, see, a lot of people talk about, well, you know, they 400. No. They, look, 400, if I were to do a movie on this, it's 400 years of making money. I'm telling you, and once again, go online. So the majority of them that bought their freedom, not all, but a good portion of them, were artisans. They made their own money. Now, in the case of the Republic of Maryland, which we did, we've done a few podcasts, two or three on that one. I did one a few days ago on the Republic of Maryland. That's what they did. Step one to their financial freedom. And they utilized this. They utilized the free enterprise capitalistic system of that time, slaves now. And that's how they were able to purchase their freedom. They were able to charter a boat to make a voyage to Africa, and that's how the Republic of Africa was formed. Now, we have that archive, so you can go back and play that, or you can go on Wikipedia and look up the Republic of Maryland and but we've covered that topic at least, that whole movement at least three times, including within the last few days. Yesterday we covered the Kentucky in Africa. Today, where people, a group of ex-slaves or former slaves, got together in the state of Kentucky, did the same thing for the Maryland folk. This is all before the Emancipation Proclamation, people. All before Lincoln. No computers, no smartphones, no internet connections, no tablets, no desktops, none of that. No library, no public library we can get where you can tap into all this. All right, now, today we're going to talk about Mississippi. Once again, you can fact check me. I'm reading straight off of Wikipedia, which I've been doing for the last 8 consecutive days. And one of the things that we would like to plan with you guys, an offline activity, let's get together. We're going to have to do some planning on it. Let's all go to Liberia, because Liberia annexed a lot of these places as you know, time went on. But a lot of the colonies that they did start still exist to this day. The Republic of Maryland no longer exists. That existed for like 23 years, 22, 23 years. Today, it is now known as Maryland County, Liberia. That's what it's known as today. All right. And a lot of these places, we can find them in Liberia today. Now, Mississippi and Africa. Mississippi and Africa was a colony on the Pepper Coast of West Africa, founded in the 1830s by the Mississippi Colonization Society of the United States, and settled by American free people of color, many of them former slaves. Not my words. This is on Wikipedia. And one of the reasons why I want to do a group trip there is because in their libraries and with their historians, we're going to find out a whole bunch of more information and truth than we can find in a Wikipedia article, which I'm sure you're going to have a paradigm shift in the process. But we need to be there for that. In the late 1840s, some 300 former slaves from Prospect Hill Plantation and other Isaac Ross properties in Jefferson County, Mississippi, were the largest single group of immigrants to the new colony. Now, let me put this out here. And this is why I put in the title of today's podcast, Reparations USA. In many of your reparations talks that we hear on radio and podcasts and online today, you have a good number of people, not all of them, but a good number of them, that they're looking at black people getting together on a monolithic level. Number one, nobody gets together on a monolithic level, including white folks. Liberal white folks don't agree, can't get together with conservative white folks. You know, you got the Proud Boys. You got the KKK. You know, you got white supremacist organizations outside of the KKK. You know, you got Christians. The Soviet Union, composed of some Eastern Europeans and a lot of Eurasians, which some people, just depending on where you are, you might call them white folks, but Caucasian and European are two different animals, but that's a whole different podcast. They couldn't get together. The Soviet Union broke up because they couldn't get it together and stay on the same page. So what makes you think 40 million black people in the United States in 2020 can do it? One of the clue bombs that we get from Mississippi and Africa is this. 300 former slaves, not 30,000, not 3,000, not 3 million, not 30 million, not slaves that were in all of the states of the Union at that time. 300 slaves who were in the state of Mississippi, and there were a whole lot more slaves, or former slaves, that said, We don't want to go to Africa. This is our home. I'm not going nowhere. And I already got my 40 acres or 140 acres or 400 acres. I'm straight. I'm not going nowhere. But you had some that wanted to go back to Africa. So Mississippi and Africa, which had organized 300 of them, and that was more than, that was the largest group that made their, made a successful back to Africa trip, including more than the state, the Republic of Maryland or the Republic of, or Kentucky and Africa, which Kentucky and Africa, which we covered yesterday. So that's one clue. You don't have to have a whole lot. Mother Priscilla Baltimore, it was her and 11 families, and they started their own town, which still is standing, Brooklyn, Illinois. So you don't have to have a whole lot of people. And mind you, out of these 300 people, the majority of them, of the adult population of that 300 people, they were artisans. So when they got on the ground, they didn't have to worry about how to build a house because you had artisans who knew how to build houses. You had artisans who knew how to build the infrastructure with streets and roads. You had artisans in there that were farmers. You had artisans that were seamstresses and tailors. They knew how to make clothes. They knew how to make their own shoes. So they had everything they needed when they hit the ground in Africa. They didn't have to go to the government. They didn't have to go to the social services office, which it didn't exist in anyway. They were, by studying these groups, Mississippi and Africa, that colonial group, Kentucky and Africa, that colonial group, the Republic of Maryland, that group. Study those groups, and then you'll get a good idea, a good accurate idea of what real social, operative word here, real social security is. They didn't need Wells Fargo. They didn't need Bank of America. They didn't need no bank. They were operating on social capital. When you got a group of people, and you know what, you can have as few as two, just two. And you have artisan skills, and you practice artisan economics, like the Amish do and the Mennonites do. You got everything you need. Everything they needed was in those 300 people. They didn't need Section 8. There are a lot of clues, moms, and that's why we're doing a whole month on this, and that's why we want to do a trip over to Africa to visit these places that are still standing. Okay, now, these freedmen, because that's what they were called, and other American immigrants to the colony and its neighbors, Liberia, which annexed Mississippi and Africa in 1842, okay, and the Republic of Maryland, which merged with Liberia in 1857. I was born 100 years later than that. Okay, developed the Americo-Liberians, an ethnic group who formed a political and economic elite. They dominated what became the independent country of Liberia from the late 20th century, having taken power over its indigenous natives. The Mississippi colony was located in what is now present-day Sonoma County, Liberia. Now, if you go to our blog talk page, and look at our scrolling marquee, I have a map of Sonoe County, Liberia. That's S-N-S-I-N-O-E, one word, Sonoe County, Liberia. Look that up if you're online on your computers, and you'll see a map of it. And look at that. Look at it. Look how big it is. And then look at the area of it. Snow County is 3,904 square miles. Here's another clue, Mom, folks. Former slaves, people that were born slaves, they were thinking bigger than the average person that is talking about, I want a reparations check from the United States government. They were thinking bigger than the person griping and complaining, well, we didn't get our 40 acres and a mule. I want you to go on your calculators, and I want you to get a square mile to acre, calculator. They're free. They're online. When you get there, punch in the numbers that you see here for Snow County, the area of it. Okay, now the area is, 3,914 square miles. When you break that down to acres, that's 2,504,960 acres. These black folk, our ancestors, some of our ancestors, were thinking bigger then in 1830 than we're thinking now on a critical mass basis in 2022. Now, that's what they did. That's why I want to organize a trip with you guys. Let's go, because some of you need to see this in person. See, it's one thing reading about it online, but you need to stand in it. And I'm pretty sure that you'll go through a paradigm shift when you're there. I'm already going through a paradigm shift, and I haven't even gone there yet. 2,504,960 and 300 people. All right. Let's see. Continuing on. Let's see. Part of the history is most free blacks did not want to immigrate. They considered the colonization plan as a means to export them. They believe that they have a natural-born claim to be in the United States. Like I said, not everybody was on board with this. And that's all right. The 300... That didn't deter the 300 from doing what they were going to do. All right. I'll let you know, there's a map of Mississippi and Africa. You can read the rest about that on your own. But I'm going to speak with a travel agent or two and work on organizing a trip so we can actually visit Maryland County, Liberia. And matter of fact, in my program notes for today, some of the things I wanted to go over is we want to talk about Greenville, Liberia. We just mentioned Snow County, Liberia. where 300 black folks got together and ponied up to get over 2 million acres of land. See, that's thinking big. That's 300 of them. All right, artisan economics, most of the ones that they were artisans. Slave entrepreneurship buys you freedom. Let's see. Okay. Before we get into Greenville, Liberia, let's come into the future, the present age. There's a lady, some of you might have heard of her before, and you can read about her online. She's still among the living. Young lady, Sharon Terabasi. Sharon Terabasi. Terabasi is spelled T-E-R-I-B-A-S-S-I. That's Terabasi. Sharon, S-H-A-R-O-N. Sharon's the first name. Terabasi is her last name. That's spelled T-E-R-I-B-A-S-S-I. Sharon Terabasi. Sharon Terabasi, who was a Canadian, won a Canadian lottery for millions of dollars. As a matter of fact, let me look that up, because I don't want y'all saying, L.A.'s bad mouthing black folks. So I'm going to read it. All right, I'm going online. Sharon Terabasi, from millionaire to living paycheck to paycheck. All right. If you played a lottery, you've likely dreamed about what you do if you won the jackpot. In that dream, it probably feels like you have an endless supply of cash. While many jackpot winners receive a huge windfall, and the fact of the matter is the cash flow will eventually end. Unfortunately, many winners don't prepare for this eventuality, and many end up regretting it. That's exactly what happened to lottery winner Sharon Terabasi. If you look her up online, you'll see her holding her check, and she happens to be a black woman, a black Canadian. All right. Who is Sharon Terabasi? Sharon Terabasi is a Canadian woman who came to recognition when she won a large lottery jackpot prize. Living in Hamilton, Ontario at the time of the win, Terabasi, raising her three children and living in a rented apartment, Terabasi had a rough childhood living in shelters in the teen years. In early 2004, just before a big win, Terabasi had recently come off of welfare and started a job as a personal care provider, although she had no car to get her there. How much money did Sharon Terabasi win? Everything changed for Sharon Terabasi on Easter weekend 2004, when she checked her lottery Super 7 ticket and learned that she had won the jackpot. The winning jackpot for the draw was an incredible $10.5 million Canadian. In total, she received a check for $10,569,010. And she got to keep all of it, as winners do not get to this is in Canada. Winners do not have to claim lottery winnings as income and funds that are not subject to lottery tax in Canada. How did Sharon Terabasi spend her money? I'm reading this. This is not L.A. speaking. I'm just reading. Don't throw any stones at me. I'm just the messenger today. All right. Terabasi was generous with her stroke of luck and shared her money with friends and family. Her first action with a windfall was to split the winnings among family. $1 million to her parents, another $1.5 million split to her four siblings, and often the case with jackpot winners, Terabasi was suddenly approached by many friends, new and old, when news, read the rest of Sharon. Her ass is back, paycheck to paycheck. She bought the house, she bought the big car. Man, her and all those other people, she did set up something for her kids. She did set aside some of that money for a trust fund for her kids. So kudos to her on that. But probably one of the smartest things, and I'm Monday morning quarterbacking on this, for Sharon to do, and what I'm learning how to do, is become a artisan. Learn how to make something. Cupcakes. Learn how to make underwear, socks. Grow food. That strategy, that economic strategy, I'm going to even call it high finance. These former slaves that went and formed Kentucky and Africa, and got hold of over 2 million acres of land, and Kentucky and Africa, the Republic of Africa, Liberia, Sierra Leone, the former slaves that did all that were practicing what I call high finance. I don't need to go. I do not need to give another book, personal finance section. I'm just studying what these artisans did, and that's what we'll be doing this year, practicing artisan economics. Brother Beasley he's donated some seeds for our first garden. We haven't planted those yet, but we'll give you, because I got to find somebody who knows how to. I'm not a green thumb at all, so we're gonna get somebody to walk us to go through that. So we got enough for that right now. But, you know, we'll be building stuff. And we're going to be teaching and preaching. That matter of fact, that's how we're going to get the money to make our trip to Africa to study these communities up close and personal on the continent. We're going to practice artisan economics. And that's all right if you don't know how to make anything, because when these people were born, you know, they didn't come out of their mother's womb knowing how to build furniture or build ships or grow food or make clothes. They had to learn that skill. Just probably a better analogy of this is you take, I think you got the Winter Olympics, the Olympics, okay. Your Olympic track stars, the fastest humans on Earth, when they were born, because we're all born the same, when we're born, we don't know, they had to crawl. And learn how to crawl. They had to learn how to set themselves up. They had to learn how to crawl. They had to learn how to walk. And then finally had to learn how to run. Just like we all do. And some of us, you're like Sharon Terabasi. See, when she got that $10 million, she wasn't a millionaire in her mind. She could have taken that $10 million and turned it into maybe $10 billion. But you got to think that way. Sharon Terabasi does not have any artisan skill. She doesn't know how to make a broom. Doesn't know how to build a boat. She might not even know how to make cupcakes. And that's one of the reasons why we were to get a reparations check today. The same thing. Now, it won't happen with everybody, but the same thing that happened to Sharon Terabasi on a critical mass basis will happen to a lot of other people. That's just my theory. From here on out, we'll be giving offline workshops on artisan economics. And for people that want to become artisans, and basically artisans are people who make things. You know, cupcakes, furniture, clothes. These people just, it's simple, man. Just simple, basic, what I call high finance. Just simple. None of these people went to Harvard or Yale. To, you know, Wharton Business School. So, you know, that's what we've covered today. Mississippi and Africa. Check it out online. And we're going to set some dates where we're going to be, you know, if you want to become an artisan. Our thing on being an artisan, we'll have two things for you: growing your own food and building off-grid houses. That's our lane. But, you know, we'll take ideas from the rest of you as well.
YouTube, go ahead and hit that like button and make sure that you share this video. All right, man, let's get to the nitty-gritty here. You know what I mean? Corey Holcomb, you know, who was a very respected, you know, activist, comedian, you know, whatever you want to call him. I think you said he had a podcast for about a decade now.
50.
Yeah, definitely respected. You know, salute to what you do. Salute, you know, to, you know, just being bold and speaking your mind. We definitely, you know, salute that and appreciate that. But it's a clip that came out the other day that's been making, you know, some you know, pretty splashes in the black community, where he's coming out and pretty calling, you know, people out by name, namely, I ain't even going to say nothing. I'm just going to play the video and we're going to talk about this shit, man. This is crazy right here.
Your money ran off with it. Because I done met these niggas.
Man, yeah, me too.
When I go up to the Zoe show,
yeah.
I done met a nigga. And when I look at this nigga on the internet, I be like, this nigga is a crook.
Right.
This nigga ran off with all them people's money.
Yeah. Shit, he didn't even run. He just turned the internet off and went to sleep.
I ain't gonna say no names. I ain't gonna say no names, but he was polite about it. Anybody who know what I'm talking about, he was polite about it.
Man.
Got your money. You entrusted in a motherfucker. Talk about R. Kelly or some shit. Motherfucker, you gave a sucker-ass nickel your money, and he ran off with,
man.
No, motherfuckers talking about Umar Johnson. Yeah, Umar Johnson got your money, too. He said he was going to get a school, but motherfuckers put the shit up there. Polite.
Oh, yeah, that nigga traveling. That nigga all over the world. Nigga riding elephants and buying bitches' titties.
Wow. There's motherfuckers out here who are real predators, scam artist niggas.
Yeah, straight out.
You know what I'm saying? But it ain't no Lifetime channel about that because they really don't know that much about them.
A lot said. First of all.
Okay. Now, you have a lot of that kind of banter here in 2022. And you probably had some of that in 1830. But the distinction between 1830 and 2020 is this. Number one, these 300 people, and it's 300 people, man. That's a lot of people. These 300 people that made this voyage to Africa, this back to Africa trip, like I say, they were artisans, practiced artisan economics. So everybody knew who can make a pair of shoes, a cobbler. Everybody knew, you know, who was a carpenter, who can build furniture. You know, they probably had a plan on what they want to do to get shelter, for them to provide shelter for themselves before they even set sail on a boat. They knew about social capital. And they weren't relying upon the United States dollar. Because if you got a skill set on making things and growing food or how to catch food, That's your money. So there probably weren't any Corey Holcombs back then. And Corey Holcomb, unless he knows how to tell jokes, I don't think he even knows how to build a house. Or grow food or anything like that. So another topic I wanted to cover is Greenville, Liberia. Now, I've been to Greenville, Mississippi. My stepfather was there. I visited that place one time. But within the Mississippi to Africa group, let me read about it. Greenville, Liberia. Greenville is the capital of Sonoma County in southeastern Liberia and lays on a lagoon near the Sonoma River and the Atlantic Ocean. It is located 150 miles southeast of Monrovia. As of 2008, national census population stood at 16,434 people. Let's see. The town of Greenville, Liberia, was built in 1838. Once again, Abraham Lincoln was nowhere near the scene. By colonists of the Mississippi Colonization Society. Part of what was then was the Mississippi and Africa Colony. Now, Sonoma County. So, Mississippi and Africa, that group is known by Sonoma County. And once again, convert the square miles of Sonoma County down to acres. That's over 2.5 million acres. They were thinking big. And there was no radio back then, no TV, none of that. So they couldn't get into any name calling like we can did today. Which is better on their behalf. All right. Anyway, let's see. Town of was destroyed by the Liberian Civil War. That's basically blacks against blacks. Okay, but has since been rebuilt. Now, this calls for a whole nother podcast. We can't do it today, but we got to do a podcast on Black Wall Street versus Greenville, Liberia. Both towns were destroyed. Well, no. Black Wall Street was not a town. Black Wall Street was a 40-acre neighborhood located in Tulsa, Oklahoma. Greenville, Liberia, was an actual town. But the people that rebuilt Greenville, Liberia, they didn't sit around for 200 years talking about how somebody in victim mode. They practiced artisan economics because they knew how to rebuild what was destroyed. We'll do a podcast on that one day. Since then, it has been rebuilt around a port and the logging industry. Before the Civil War, the town's main exports were lumber, rubber, and agricultural products. This is all black folks. From who started out here in the United States. Greenville, Liberia, is the third largest port in Liberia. The port has two quays, 170 meters, I guess it's meters. And now there's 180 meters long. I'm thinking that's, you know, I need to look up the dimensions on that, respectively. And then we have a copy of Sonoma County. Oh, Greenville, Liberia, is within the city, within the county of Sonoma County, Liberia. So thank God for social media. What I'm working on is meeting people from Greenville. So every place that we've talked about for the last 8 days, I'm working on getting people on here to be on this live stream. But then we also want, that's step one, because I also want to build social capital so we can make a trip over there and see a lot of this stuff in person. And then we can go to their libraries and get their history. You know, there's stuff in their library that we're not going to find over here at all, including the Library of Congress. So Greenville, Liberia is a Americo-Liberian city that black folks built and is still standing to this day. So some of the you know what, that's why if reparations checks are cut, I don't want mine that way. I don't want mine from the state. For me, reparations, now this is just for me, is to adopt the lifestyle and the monetized skill sets that these people had. Become an artisan. Make something and become good at making it. One of the people, slave entrepreneurs that we covered last week was Junius George Groves, born a slave in the United States. His artisan skill set was as a farmer. He became the potato king of the world. When he was living, he produced more potatoes for commercial sale than anybody on the planet while he was alive. He's on Wikipedia, too. So my reparations are these people that we've been covering and these communities that these people organized, these Zuzus that these people organized. I mean, they organized Zuzus to start a country, a county, and cities, towns. So it can be done. It can be done because it has been done, and a lot of these places are still standing. So my reparations for me is, okay, become an artisan. And that's going to pay me dividends. Then I can teach others how to do the same thing. And it just keeps on giving. And there's no way that I can get that from a government. There's no check that a government can cut that'll cover that. But that's for me now. All right. Let me see. All right, well, if you got any guys' comments, 619-768-2945 on Mississippi and Africa, Artisan Economics versus USA Today. Just call, press 1, we'll get you on.
Get your money and ran off with it. Because I done met these niggas. Man,
I say some shit to y'all that I seen yesterday that made me smile, but it hurt me to my heart. There's a house next door to me that's been abandoned. And the yard, the grass, high as hell and everything. There's a couple of abandoned cars out there beside the house. Well, yesterday I get off work about 7 o'clock. A Mexican guy pulled up. He said, "These your cars?" I said, "No." He said, "I just bought this house, man." I said, "All right, that's what's up." He was like, "You know whose cars these is?" He said, "No." He said, "Well, I bought the house, not the cars." Okay, I'm like, cool. I'm thinking he's just coming to look at the house. I go back in the house, do a little straighten up. I swear to God, I walk back out the house. Now, I'm getting off about 7:20. It's fucking 9 Mexican trucks just pulled up. They got fucking beer, lights, and shit, right? So I'm like, what y'all finna do? He said, "We finna fix this house."
I said, what kind of crew you got working after 7 o'clock? He said, these my friends. The fucking house is fixed this morning. They went in there and drywalled that fucking house. I just left out of there. It was a fucking abandoned house. That bitch looked new this morning. Woo. It was an abandoned fucking house. And it looked new this morning. It's an old African proverb. Many hands make light work. I just don't think they're better than us. I just think we won't do nothing together. Wow. You're not hearing what the fuck I'm saying. It was an abandoned house yesterday at 7:15. That bitch is new this morning. He bought a tax lien house. I can't wait to see what they do. I can't wait to see, is one family gonna live in there? Is they gonna, I'm gonna get to know the motherfuckers. You best believe me, when I make some money, I'm gonna do it. I'm gonna bring us together. And I'm not fucking with a lot of people.
Excuse me. Let's take a look at how Mississippi and Africa, which did this in practice way before that audio was ever done or even thought about. There were 300 of them. Mississippi and Africa was the biggest group of immigrants to leave the United States, or they became immigrants when they reached Africa. They were American, most of them former slaves. Freedmen. 300 of them. 300 of them, most of them had their hands, you know, maybe someone got, maybe some of them chopped off, but let's just keep it simple for the math. 300 people times two hands each, that's 600 hands. 600 hands organized to buy over 2.5 million acres of land. 600 hands helped develop that county, Sano County, Africa, which stands today. 600 hands helped build the town of Greenville, Liberia. The town still stands today. I've been to Greenville, Mississippi. My stepfather was from there. And just on GP, that's one of my motivating factors to get over to Greenville, Liberia. I know what it's like in Greenville, Mississippi. But I want to know what it's like in Greenville, Liberia.
Run for your life! Everyone run for cover!
SOS! Mayday! Mayday! Code Red! Duck and cover!
You're all in danger! Run for cover! Run for your life!
Emergency! Emergency!
Yeah.
Chicken Little! What is it? What's going on?
The sky is falling! The sky is falling!
The sky is falling?
Are you crazy? No, it's true!
And now, an exclusive first look at the upcoming documentary, 7 a.m.
Because true economic science is a branch of military science. War and money go hand in hand. Most wars are fights so people can make more money, and war is money. That means what? That the European American is not about to prepare black children to compete with his children for control of the economic sector. It's not going to happen. So if black people want this science, we got to teach it, we got to study it, and we're going to have to make some mistakes in perfecting it because we're still babies in the water of global economic commerce. As African people, we are financially illiterate, so we should not be surprised.
I'm going to make my own version of this, Art of War. I think Dr. Umar has complicated what's needed. These people who, Mississippi in Africa, Kentucky in Africa, the Republic of Maryland, and there were other groups, by 1830 they had mastered global economics. Number one, they didn't try to do what white folks do. They weren't running behind white folks. That was not their metric. Their metric was on what they can do with their own skill sets within their community. I mean, if buying your freedom from slavery then through a business that you establish as a slave, during the time when slavery was legal in the United States, and then getting together and networking with other people and planning with other people about this place called Africa, and, you know, how are we going to get there? You know, what resources do we have? What resources do you have? What resources do we have collectively? You know, What are we going to do for shelter when we get there? How are we going to eat on a completely different continent? I would say they had global politics and economics down pat before the ship sailed. With no college degrees, with no Umar Johnsons in this case, thank goodness. And I like Dr. Umar now, but in this case, I think he missed the boat I'm gonna play the rest of that audio. I'm totally reevaluating Dr. Umar Johnson, and to a high degree, Dr. Claude Anderson. That's why I want to organize a trip so we can go to these places. These people, in my opinion, had mastered global I'm going to play the rest of this and then...
And now, an exclusive first look at the upcoming documentary, 7 a.m.
Because true economic science is a branch of military science. War and money go hand in hand. Most wars are fights so people can make more money, and war is money. That means what? That the European American is not about to prepare black children to compete with his children for control of the economic sector. It's not going to happen. So if black people want this science, we got to teach it, we got to study it, and we're going to have to make some mistakes in perfecting it because we're still babies in the water of global economic commerce. As African people, we are financially illiterate. So we should not be surprised that we're so economically backward because we were never taught how to be economically forward. Our education in America has not provided or prepared us to be able to compete with Europeans economically. The historically black college was designed to do what? Teach you how to work for white people. Public schools, charter schools, parochial schools, independent schools. What is the purpose of education in America for black children right now? To teach them how to make a living working for white people. But I don't want the kids coming to my school to be going to class thinking that I'm learning this so I can go and get paid by a white person. They're going to be empowered to start their own business. When they leave that school, they're going to go into business. And why do we need our people to be self-sufficient? Because when you're not self-sufficient, you can't speak your mind. One of the biggest reasons why black people have been so cowardly in the post-civil rights movement, not standing up for ourselves, standing up for our children, standing up against police brutality, we're scared to lose our jobs. We have to work. We got kids. I can't talk about the racism on my job. I might lose it. So the reason why we're not speaking our mind is because we don't have economic freedom. As Mr. Garvey said, Marcus Garvey said, that a solid racial program must be built on a solid economic foundation. Show me your economic condition, and I'll show you your political condition. The political economy of the black community rests on the premise that because they do not make their own money, they are enslaved to Europeans. And as a result of that, they will never be able to do what needs to be done to carve out a future for their children, because the hand that pays is also the hand that rules them.
Okay, let's, and like I said, I'm going to have to do my own Art of War, because some of the facts here, and like I said, we shall be doing a field trip to these places, and I'll let you, I'm going to call it travel aid. Well, hold it, I can't, she's off today. Tomorrow, actually, I'm going to deal with two travel agents if you guys want to come on this, because I want this to be a group field trip. Okay, now, I'm saying that there were groups of black people back in the 1830s that were more sophisticated in global geopolitics and global finance than maybe one of your Harvard graduates or Wharton School of Business graduates today. And today we've talked about Mississippi and Africa. Now, I want to go to Sonoke County. Now, we already know from the backstory that Sonoke County, which is in now present-day Liberia, that was helped form by the colonial group Mississippi and Africa. All right? Mississippi of Africa was made up of 300 people who were born mostly slaves. Myth one busted up is that slaves did work for free. Well, that's not true in all cases, because the people who started out legally as slaves that were members of the Mississippi and Africa colonial group, they were artisans. Once again, artisans, and I'm repeating myself a lot, because this ain't typical Black History Month stuff. Artisans are people who make things. Carpenters, seamstresses, cupcake makers, metal workers. You know, people that can build roads. People who are landscape architects, people. They were artisans. That's how they earned money. A lot of times, these plantations that were owned by white people, they needed a skilled artisan to run the plantation. See, I don't watch these movies that come out of Hollywood, these slave movies. I don't watch them because the stuff that, and everything I'm talking about is right on Wikipedia. And some of it's on YouTube also. They don't give that part of the story. So a lot of you guys go to see these movies, 12 Years a Slave and Roots this and Kunta Kinte that, and then you get mad. And you haven't seen the whole landscape of the picture. Because many, once again, many slaves became entrepreneurs. They didn't hide it. It was well known. many of the plantations that existed, because you did have enough, you did have a number of black folks that was slave owners and plantation owners too. But I'm talking about the white ones. Many of the white plantations were run by skilled artisans, people who were skilled at growing food, people that were skilled at building that big house. See, let's put some things in perspective here. Okay. Now, so let's get back to Mississippi and Africa. So this group of 300 people, and you know you got to have children in there. So, you know, some of them, I don't know how young they started working, but yeah, a group of 300 people that went from Mississippi to Africa, they bought over 2.5 acres of land. That 2.5 million plus acres of land now today is known as Sanoa County, Liberia. Where's the slave movie that tells you that story? That's why I don't watch that shit. I don't watch that. The only Django is the only one I watch. The rest of it, 12 Years a Slave. I don't do the slave movie thing. And I'm not waiting on Hollywood to put one out. That's something we're going to have to do. Okay, now, when it comes to economy, all right, in Sanoa County, as of 2011, the area rice plantation was over 8,300 hectares, which is 21,000 acres. Let's see, what else? Putting out a production of 680 metric tons. Let's start having those discussions in some of these reparations talks. How many metric tons of carrots? How many metric tons of potatoes? How many metric tons of anything that you're going to make as an artisan, practicing artisan, African artisan economics? How many, let's start talking about metric tons instead of this 40 acres and a mule. If you go online and you look up the reparations bill that was passed in, Evanston, Illinois, Sea of Metric Tons is mentioned anywhere in that language. So we got to start thinking bigger. Before I go to the phone lines here, let's look up metric ton. Okay. A metric ton is a unit of weight equal to 1,000 kilograms, or converted to pounds, 2,205 pounds. That's what a metric ton is. 2,205 pounds. That's what a metric ton is. We need to start using this vocabulary. How many metric tons cakes are you going to bake? How many metric tons of, once again, pick how many metric tons of watermelon do you plan on growing and harvesting this year? That's the way they were thinking. But let me go back in the time machine. Let's see. 1830. 192 years ago. That's the way they were thinking. They were printing their money by making things and growing food. That's all a part of the artisan economy. So we're going to have, every week, we're going to mention something about artisan economics. And then, you know, who's producing metric tons of this or that? How many metric tons of clothes can you make and sell, then turn around and sell? We're going to be talking about ports. You know, they built their own ports. .980, your mic is open.
Yeah, hello.
Yeah, yeah, we can hear you.
Okay. Yeah, I've been enjoying what I'm hearing. How often do you broadcast?
Say that again.
How often do you do this show?
Oh, Monday. But we go Monday through Friday, 10:30 a.m.
10:30. Eastern.
Eastern Standard Time. Yeah, Eastern Standard Time.
10:30 Eastern. Okay. I guess my other question is, do you do this on YouTube as well, or do you just do it on Blogspot?
No, we're going to have to do this on YouTube because people are mostly visual. Yeah, this we're going to have to start matter of fact.
I think you would get more time on YouTube.
What I'm going to have to do is, wait a minute. I'm going to take your number, and I'm not going to announce it over there, but that way I can stay in touch with you and let you know when we'll be on. This month, instead of doing the traditional Black History Month thing, I picked out three little niches within Black History. Because we all heard about Frederick Douglass and George Washington Carver and Harry. We know those people. But this month we go through slave entrepreneurs, which basically we've been, for the last 8 consecutive days, we've been featuring people who were born slaves in what we now call the United States, and they became entrepreneurs, and some became wealthy, even to the millionaire level, way before Madam C.J. Walker. And all this stuff is right online. I've been reading from Wikipedia every day. We probably named about 3 people that started Black townships. One we talked about today, Greenville, Liberia, which is a complement or probably a de facto sister city to Greenville, Mississippi. Because today we covered Mississippi in Africa, which was a colonial outfit where they went over and they purchased over 2.5 million acres of land. That's Sonoke County. And then Greenville, Liberia, is within Sonoke County. But that all comes from the Mississippi and Africa colonial movement. Yesterday we covered Kentucky and Africa. And a lot of these places, they all have towns that are intact, towns and or counties that are intact to this day in Liberia, but the founders were born here right in the United States. Most of them were born slaves. Not all, but most. And so we're covering things like that for this month of February, which is a little bit different from, you know, the typical Black history stuff.
Oh yeah, I'm enjoying it. It reminds me. Have you read these books? It's a book called Collective Courage by Dr. Emhart. That's a sister who emphasizes everything you're talking about: artisans, group economics, cooperatives. She put the history, at least domestically. She had a whole history of all these movements that where we from the freedom schools and so on that she put in his book.
Oh, hold it, by Collective Courage, by Jessica Gordon.
Collective Courage.
Man, thank you so much.
Jessica Nimar. Yep, Jessica Nimar. That's
right.
Her.
Thank you a lot for that. Okay.
It's a great book.
She's got some video,
the,
too.
In the Black Business Encyclopedia, that's another one.
Okay.
That's another one. The Black Business Encyclopedia is another one. All those things have a lot of information regarding the stuff that you're talking about right now. Historically,
okay, you said Black Business Encyclopedia?
Yeah, Black Business Encyclopedia. It's a big book. It's an expensive book, but it's a big book. It's very expensive. It's a college. It's a college price book. But it's a wealth of information in there. It's a wealth of information. But I like that you're talking about group economics and buying land.
Yeah, we
and,
have successfully
and building on that land. Yeah,
right. We've successfully done it in the past. So, because a lot of people today, you might hear, well, Black folks don't work together. But that, you don't. First thing, you're not trying to get every single person. Just get who you can work with.
Right.
So, in the case that we've been putting out, for every matter of fact, every day, the common denominator with these, even the people that went from slave to entrepreneur and got wealthy or started a town. It was all done by cooperative economics. Every last single case. It was not nobody solo that did it by themselves. Every last single person. And they did it primarily with the help of Black folk, and in some cases, white folks helped too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I put it out there because, that's where we're at with all this.
Yeah, I love this. I love talking about this.
We're going to have to do some YouTube videos. So I figured, let's organize a trip. Trip over to Africa to these places so people can actually see it. And then speaking about books, let's go to their libraries and then read what they have on their shelves that have, they've got information that hasn't hit online.
That's right.
Well, there are people that don't know over here. So, brother, give me your first name, and then I got your number.
Yeah.
And I'll stay in touch with you.
Yeah, first name is Idris, Idris.
All right. Idris. And you said Smith? What's the last name? Oh, no, Idris.
No,
that's all I need, Idris. That's all I need.
Yeah.
Okay. And, I done looked at the two books you talked about already, and I done screenshot them. I'm going to be looking at that myself. But, I'm looking at, for personal finance, just really follow what these people did. Like, for instance, my grandmother on my mother's side, she only had a fifth or sixth grade education. And she didn't have a 9-to-5 job. At least I lived with her and my grandfather for a year, and they didn't go to work nowhere. But my mother taught all of her, because my grandmother had seven kids, one boy and then six girls. So all the girls, by the time they left home, and my mother left home at 17, they knew how to make their own clothes. They can look at a piece of clothing, a garment, pants, shirt, underwear, coat, winter coat, and they can make, by sight, they can make a pattern from that and then make a garment from that. And that was taught all by my grandmother. So my grandfather was blind. So essentially, my grandmother, through her seamstress skills, she knew how to catch fish, and then her mother, my great-grandmother, lived on an 88-acre farm Well, I call it a farm, but who knows? It could have been a plantation at one time. It was certainly, it's certainly big enough. You know, so that's how they, you know, they got food, and that's how they made it. So I call it simple personal finance. And like I said, that's just with a fifth or sixth grade education. So I think if we get back to the basics, of how did these people make it? Because you still needed some type of currency or wealth to do what they did. But this book that you have, mm-hmm. I'm just looking at the title alone, Collective Courage. And that's what it was. It was collective courage. I mean, because they went from, you know, it wasn't like, you had no airplanes that existed back then. So they went by what people told them and what kind of limited research they can do. But they had the skill sets. They knew, well, if we get over to anywhere in the world, we know how to build a house. We know how to source our own material. You know, we know how to forage food while we're waiting for food to grow. You know, and how we can assess soils and this type thing. So, thank you for calling in. I got you locked into my phone. And I'll be in touch. And if you got any other books to recommend, let us know.
Definitely. I appreciate it.
Okay. Thank you, Idris. Thank you, everybody, for listening. We'll be back tomorrow with more information on slave entrepreneurship.